Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we're going to be discussing a recent book chapter by Dr. Yanhui Zhang. Yanhui is Assistant Professor of Applied Linguistics and a specialist in second language acquisition and pedagogy.
Yanhui holds a PhD in second language acquisition from Carnegie Mellon University and was an assistant professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong before joining the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China. Her research focuses on computer-assisted language learning and Chinese-English bilingual literacy development. And full disclosure, Mary, Yanhui and I have published a number of things together and worked together in that area of pedagogy and technology.
Full disclosure?
Full disclosure.
I think you should have told me this beforehand. This is a definite conflict of interest, Derek.
My goodness.
I
know, because I try my best to publish with everybody.
I know. You know too many people. You're too friendly. You should be more like me.
I will be bitter and alienated as best as I can be.
Good to hear it. Yanhui's chapter is titled Development of Morphological Awareness and Its Impact Upon Reading Among Young Learners of Chinese as a Heritage Language, and is published with her colleagues Keiko Koda, Qinlong Yang, and Chang Lu. The chapter is part of the book Reading in Chinese as an Additional Language, Learners' Development, Instruction, and Assessment, edited by Liu Li and Dongbo Zhang, and was published by Routledge in 2023. So, Derek, you have published in this field before, of course. So I feel really kind of lacking in knowledge here. I'm surrounded by basically two experts in applied linguistics.
I'd like to pretend I am, but actually this is not precisely what I do.
What do you do?
Many people have asked that question and no one has yet to answer it. This is about morphology, and it's about morphology in Chinese. And in addition,
Derek, yeah. What's morphology?
Oh, that's a very good question. We should actually let Yanhui answer that, because my understanding of morphology is a little bit different. So Chinese characters in written form take on a very different meaning in terms of what we would look at as morphology. So morphology in English is basically how different units of meaning map onto each other so that you can have a core or a root morpheme, which is, I like monkeys. Monkeys is a good example. So monkeys as a word is two morphemes. There's monkey, which has one unit of meaning, and zzz, which gives the plural meaning onto it. So it means more than one monkey.
Okay. Is that phonetic then? Does that mean? Does this relate to whether or not something is phonetic?
We better let Yanhui answer this, because this
You're
does...
You're backing out of an answer
I
here,
I will answer if you want. So, okay. Phonemes are the smallest units of sound.
Oh.
And the difficulty is in Chinese, because of the way that it's set up, there are combinations in Chinese of more than one phoneme, but then morphemes usually are correlated with a single character. However, in writing, we're looking at the morphemics of the character having more than one unit of meaning in and of itself. Okay. So I think it's better if we let Yanhui explain this, because I could be wrong. and I'd hate to be wrong on a podcast. So Yanhui, maybe what you could do, if you don't mind, is give us a brief introduction to the chapter itself. And if there are terms like this that may not be so common, we'll let Mary jump in on it.
Thank you.
Only because
thank
I'm
you.
Familiar with
Just
them.
Just because you already know all of this already. Thank you. Okay. Yanhui, please do explain it better than Derek.
Okay, thank you, Derek and Mary, for the discussion just now. And you have already provided some explanations of the terminologies. Of course, as Derek mentioned, the morphology in Chinese is basically the same as English, but there are some a little bit differences in terms of the orthography. So the study of this chapter mainly focuses on the acquisition of morphology and reading comprehension. So how these two concepts closely connect together. And so the special part of this study is that the participants of the learners, they are called heritage language learners. So
I think this was the part of the paper that interested me the most, because when you say heritage language, you're basically talking about Chinese people who are in the Chinese diaspora. They live internationally, but they are still learning Chinese and learning to read and write Chinese. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. So this heritage children, mostly children, yeah, because the children, they grow up in the family who speak Chinese, but they have to learn how to write Chinese in the school, because in at home, they are pretty fluent in communicating in daily language with their parents and their relative and the community. But for Chinese writing, as we most people know, Chinese writing is learning how to write is another story. So we are very curious about these heritage learners. So they are quite fluent in oral language. But how do they learn how to write?
This is fascinating for me. Is there a big demand for this service internationally, not learning actually to speak and to listen? So not learning to understand in that way, but learning to read and write. Is there a big demand for that among the Chinese diaspora?
Yes, it's not just Chinese, it's among the many of the heritage language learners. For example, like Russian people immigrated to UK or immigrated to the United States, and they have to learn how to write in Russian scripts.
Wow. So does this involve a specific style of teaching? I mean, can you be trained to only teach reading and writing in this way?
Yes. So that means they cannot get the writing just from oral pronunciations. Is unlike the other languages who are very transparent. For example, Italian, if you know how to speak, and then you naturally know how to write, but not really in Chinese, because Chinese is, there's no direct associations between the pronunciation and the grapheme.
That for me is absolutely fascinating. Is it the lack of a language being, say sort of phonetic? Because myself, I can speak pretty good Thai from when I lived in Thailand. And I learned to read and write a little bit as well. And the reading and writing wasn't very difficult once you'd actually learned the alphabet and you'd learned all the vowels to go with it, because it was mostly, not always, but mostly quite phonetic. But I guess that's not the same with the kind of languages that require this separate reading and writing tuition.
Yes, that's why we want to study Chinese, because Chinese offer a very typical example that people, they know how to speak, but they not necessarily know how to write the characters.
Thank you very much. I think you've sort of outlined why it is necessary to make this study. Could you give us an actual overview then of actually the paper? So what was your main argument? What did you actually find out?
Okay, yes. So the paper is mostly about using the heritage language learners, Chinese heritage language learners, as a specific target to understand the learning of orthography. This orthography, they mean like the learners, because Chinese is a very special language, the phoneme and the grapheme doesn't really correspond to each other. So it means that learners, they know how to speak the language, but they have to read a lot. They have to acquire the orthography from print. Okay, but the heritage learners, unlike those Chinese children born in China and grow up in China, they are exposed to the spoken language and the print at the same time. But in the heritage language learners, they have very limited exposure to prints. So how do they learn how to write? And what's the role of morphology play in the learning of orthography? And with the kind of development, how different this kind of development be from the native children who study Chinese in mainland China? So we want to know more about this. And this is a very unique angle to look into the problem from this heritage Chinese language learners.
Fascinating. So Why specifically did you become interested in the heritage language learner? Was this a personal thing? Did you know somebody or one of your co-authors know somebody who, say, grew up in this situation? Or did you observe it as a teaching technique? I'm really interested as to how you got into this. Because clearly, as well, in the paper, you had access to language learners, weren't you? You were able to go into a school and actually test the children there. So could you tell us more about maybe why you were so interested in this and how you got access to these participants?
Yes. Okay. So these participants are quite normal in the US and in other English-speaking countries. A lot of parents, they immigrated or they study in the US, and then their children grow up in the US in another country. And because of the unique aspects I mentioned in Chinese, so the parents always want the children to develop writing skills. They want the children to learn how to write Chinese, but not just like how to speak fluently, but never know how to write. So they want their children to learn such skills. And there are this kind of weekend schools organized by volunteers. So these volunteers, they are parents of the Chinese families too. So they develop this kind of weekend schools and teach children Chinese culture and Chinese language in the weekends. So it's in the spare time when the parents, they have finished work, and in the weekend they will send their children, and sometimes they have to force their children to go to these weekend schools and learn how to read and write. Okay. But the parents, they are very confused too, because they are not really trained teachers. They just follow their intuitions to teach these children. And the teachers there are also parents. Okay, they're not really professional teachers.
This sounds like a lot of effort for both the parents and the children. So they must have been really passionate that their children actually continue doing this.
The parents have a lot of motivation, but sometimes not really the children.
That sounds pretty familiar, actually, yeah.
True.
So how did you gain access to this school? Did you sort of just walk in and say, hey, I'd like to test your children? How did you get these participants?
We got very curious to these participants and to this population of children in the city. And then we just stopped by to the school in the weekend. And then, but they like our involvement in their study too, because they want to understand their own children and how they can do better. And they want us, this kind of linguists, applied linguists, to help them to observe the patterns of the children's growth and let them know what's the difficulties of the children's learning and how they can improve. That's why we can get access to the children and run some experiments on them and observe their learning. And so that's why we come up with this paper.
It sounds like the parents were very happy to have you there. What were the children like to you, though? It sounds like they're less enthusiastic about having to study linguistics on a weekend.
True, especially the children when they grow up. For the population we were observing, they are okay because they're 9 to 12 years old children. They're still young. Their parents can still force them to go to the school to learn Chinese reading and writing, but not really the older children. Yeah. So the older children, they will give up. They have a lot of arguments with the parents.
So one thing I was curious about, Yanhui, because there's a tension between the kind of diaspora community in Chinese and the mainland, in the sense that there may be differences between the traditional characters and the simplified characters. And I noticed some of the examples in your paper were using traditional characters, not simplified. Does that make a difference in terms of reading acquisition? Because, of course, the mainland changed their writing system with something like 800 of the most common characters to allow literacy to be simpler, and we're demanding outside of China that a lot of these communities learn the more complicated traditional characters.
Yes. Yeah, that's a movement of the Chinese government trying to promote literacy. And the simplified characters actually is a good simplification system, because after the change, after the characters are simplified, they are more systematic. Yeah. So we all know that Chinese characters have several formation patterns.
Well, not all of our listeners might know this. So let's jump in and you can explain the kind of how Chinese character might have a meaning symbol and a sound symbol and other elements, perhaps.
Yes. Chinese characters have several different kinds of formations. And the majority of the formations, characters, they are composed by two parts. One part represents, is called the semantic radical. Okay. Semantic radical conveys meanings for the character.
So an example in your paper is the symbol for gold, jin, is often put in for anything metallic.
Right. Yes. So that's the example. And the other part is the phonetic part, phonetic radical. That would convey the cue of the pronunciation.
But not always perfectly. That's the problem with being a Chinese as a second language learner, is that sometimes you can decode a character that you don't know because you can see what the radicals are in terms of around the kind of sound and what the kind of semantic meaning might be. But it's a very difficult task.
Yes, right. So that's why we need to study the transparency and saliency of this components, of these radicals. Sometimes they clearly convey the meaning of pronunciation or the semantic meaning, but sometimes not really. Of course, for children, when they study the language, study how to write, and for a second language learners, when they study Chinese characters, the easiest characters would be have a very transparent semantic radical and transparent phonetic radicals. That's the most the easiest part. So after the simplification of Chinese characters, this kind of character components, okay, the combinations are more systematic. About 80% of the Chinese characters are this kind of phonetic and semantic compound characters. So that would make it easier to learn the characters. But for the traditional characters, it's not really the story. Okay, the percentage of these compounds are less.
There's also the complication, of course, that sometimes Chinese characters are compounded so that two characters together create a different word. And do you want to explain that as well, Yanhui? I can explain this from a learner's perspective, that you have things like dianhua, which is, you know, electric speak. And these two things together equal telephone. And so sometimes when you see the compounds, you'll understand what they mean. Other times you may not know at all. And there's additional complications in Chinese that proper nouns, so the names of people or places, aren't capitalized like in English, for example. So you may be encountering a name, but if you don't know that it's a name, you can get confused by it, just for example.
Yes, that's true. So for Chinese characters, a single characters, there are compounds, and there are some compound words too. They are composed by two single characters. Okay, to make it simple, like a character might have compounds of radicals and the words would have compounds of characters. So a lot of formations of the Chinese characters or Chinese words, they are compounds. So if you have very good morphological awareness, then it's very easy to detect, to identify, to analyze, and then manipulate these components. Then if a learner has very good morphological awareness, they would learn the language much faster.
Does that awareness differ a lot between learners? I mean, do you get children who are very good at it and children who are not very good at it? Is there a wide spectrum there?
According to our study, there's no wide spectrum. Yeah. So basically, children, when they grow up, according to their language proficiency, there would be some differences. So the higher language proficiency the children would become, they will have better morphological awareness.
Were all of the participants in your study, they had a very high level of spoken Chinese?
Yes, spoken Chinese.
So yeah. They had high morphological awareness because of that language level.
But not in the characters.
Right, it's different. When they have very high oral proficiency, that means they have very good phonological awareness, but not really morphological awareness. Morphological awareness is another story.
What can improve your morphological awareness? Because I'm suspecting that I have extremely bad morphological awareness. How could I improve that?
To improve morphological awareness, the shortcut is just to read. To read a lot.
So one of the ways that children are taught Chinese and Chinese characters is through the use of pinyin. So mm-hmm. pinyin is the phonetic, I want to call it a cheat. Obviously, it's not a cheat. It's a help mm-hmm. that with any text in Chinese, you can use romanized alphabetic letters, which have a specific pronunciation. They're not exactly the same as in English or other languages, but they will give you the phonological pronunciation of a particular mm-hmm. Chinese character, along with, of course, one of the great difficulties in Chinese is that it's a tonal language, so that the same other, a non-tonal language would perceive as the same pronunciation with different tones equals different meanings.
And pinyin is taught in China. I mean, all of my students know it and they type in it when they message, don't they, on things like WeChat, for example.
True. Yes. Pinyin was taught in China when the children went to the primary one. So they all learned pinyin. And also like second language learners, when they start learning Chinese, they will learn pinyin too.
And children's books here in China, I'm a great fan of these. I go into the children's section of the local bookstore and some of them will have pinyin in them as well. So that will help out learners. But at a certain point, you want to give up on the pinyin system because it actually impedes you from reading the Chinese. And so graded readers, for example, very often come with a slotted card that you can slide down to cover up the pinyin so that you can only focus on the characters.
Yes. So for children, when they grow up, they will gradually throw away the scaffolding of pinyin. Okay, they don't have to use the cane, the stick to walk with the pinyin. They have to walk independently by reading characters so that they can improve their morphological awareness of Chinese reading.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But heritage learners are a really interesting case. So this is what I was utterly fascinated about with this paper, because in all languages, in a way, are learned primarily orally, right? So you learn through listening and speaking. All children, it's very rare, well, it's almost impossible to start a child reading and writing before that child speaks and listens, right? So there's a primacy to speech. And this in the heritage learners is, can we say, complicated or exacerbated by the fact that they are in surrounded by English and they're taking their schooling in English. So there's huge social pressures on them to use English and operate in English. And there's very little reward system for them operating in Chinese, right? So, I mean, what kind of things were you seeing on that front?
Yes, for these children, because as Derek mentioned just now, the children, they only use Chinese at home. So this is a home language, but the societal language is English. So that's why they have quite limited exposure to language. So for oral language, they only know how to say daily language. They don't really know how to use academic Chinese. And especially in reading, yeah, there's only limited exposure. Like they only use the reading in the weekend school, or maybe some families, they will have some children's books that the children can learn from this kind of limited exposure of prints. So that's why this kind of cases are so fascinating. So we can observe children's morphological awareness through this lens, through this population.
You mentioned the ages of the children that you studied. What was that again? Was that?
Actually, for the weekend school, the age covers from kindergarten to high school. But we focus specially on the children. They are 9 years old to 12 years old.
Okay, because that's quite a small age group.
Sort of age range. Yeah, we purposely chose this population mm-hmm. because children at this age, they gradually turn from learning to read to reading to learn. this kind of, there's a transition happen in this age group. So that's why we chose this age group as our subjects.
I was quite interested in what I sort of asked about at the beginning, which was the motivation of the children as well. And did you notice any change in motivation the sort of older they got? Because particularly with kind of language learning, I know that what has been noted is that the motivation of children to learn tends to get more as they get, tends to get higher as they get older. You know, sort of when you're younger, you don't really understand or see the benefits of having this. And then as you get older, you do. So I was interested if you noticed anything about the motivations of the children, because the parents are very clear, but maybe the children less so.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story, a very interesting question. Yeah, so the children, as from our observation, this population we focus on, they don't really have very strong motivation. Their motivation comes from the parents. But at the same time, when I was in the US, I was teaching Chinese as a second language. So I found that it's very interesting that the university students are very interested in learning Chinese. Their motivations are much higher. Some heritage language learners, they quit learning Chinese when they were small. Yeah, they were being forced by their parents to study Chinese, and then they argue and quarrel with the parents, and then they quit. But when they went to the university, they realized they need to learn Chinese, and then they got the fascination again. So they enrolled in the Chinese program in the university, and they got really motivated to learn. That's the thing I observe.
That is very interesting to me, because I recently returned from the UK, actually, and I met an old school friend whose child is now an early teenager, and they are white British and have no connection with China. And the child was actually learning Chinese, which I found quite fascinating. And my friend had not pushed him to learn it in any way. And the other element that interested me was actually that there was a significant interest from the teenager in learning to read and write, less so than actually learning to speak, because speaking, you have nobody to talk with, nobody to practice with, but reading and writing you do. And reading and writing is very impressive, and everybody is very impressed when you can write and read Chinese characters. So I was interested in that it seems almost quite sort of the opposite, in that there's more of an interest in the reading and writing than there is from the speaking and listening in that way.
Yeah, I think some of the teachers, they have strategies of teaching, of promoting writing too, because they offer some courses and classes on calligraphy, just like what we did in the university too.
I noticed that in your paper, you talk a lot about the cultural activities well.
Yes. So that's why this kind of activities would promote children's interest and the motivation to learn too.
One thing I wondered, Yanhui, is about the setup of this school. Are the grade levels chronological in the sense that if I'm in grade 5, I go into the grade 5 class at the Chinese school? Or are they graded levels in the sense of level of Chinese skill?
They're mostly graded according to the Chinese skills.
Oh, okay, cool. So I could go and be a kindergarten child in one of these schools, or...
Yeah, I think you're pushing it, Derek.
Okay, I could be grade 2 or 3 probably. So this is based on skill in the heritage. So how diverse are the classes then in terms of age level?
Not too diverse, because the parents, when they wanted to send the children to the school, they just did it in a certain age. They started from a certain age, and then the children gradually move on to a higher grade. So their grades are basically corresponding to the English schools they attended to.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because one of the difficulties that teaching English as a second or other language can run into is that you can have really wide-ranging classes in terms of either age or ability. So I'm wondering, in terms of heritage language, is this also a challenge that they run into?
Yeah, that's a challenge too. So that's why the schools, the weekend school principals, they would promote to have placement tests before the children enter into the classes. But basically, because they are children and there's a large variety of children, and the city I did this kind of study, there are many Chinese people there. So that's why basically the grades are equivalent to the grades the children go to in the English schools.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, so the other question I had on that front has to do with explicit versus implicit teaching, because one of the things as a Chinese, as a second language learner, when we go into an HSK class, like level four, let's say, you are explicitly looking at characters and breaking down the morphological elements of a character. And so there's an explicit teaching in Chinese as a second language that I'm wondering if that might explain some of the results that you found, that very often the students are being implicitly taught, you know, this character means this, or they're forced to memorize it. And well, let's start with that, because I have some follow-up questions as well.
Yes, this kind of explicit teaching of Chinese characters, actually, they are quite helpful for the children. Otherwise, as we mentioned earlier, some of the semantic radicals and phonetic radicals, they are not that transparent or consistent to the morpheme or phoneme.
Or even what they mean in that particular character.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why if we explicitly select some of the not so transparent characters and then let the student know that there are this kind of cue. And even for some transparent semantic radicals, for example, the radical that means water is pretty transparent. Most of the Chinese characters having this radical would convey the meaning of water. Or river. So,
or ice.
Ice has two dots, three dots.
Ooh.
Yeah. So giving this kind of cues explicitly to children would promote their morphological awareness, because they are aware if they remember this and then they can infer the meaning by reading the characters. Yeah. So they don't have to get the contextual meaning, but just read the character and then they get to know the hints. Yeah, they would know some partial information at least.
Yeah, that's very useful. Obviously, I need more of this as well. But in terms of the Chinese system, then, how much of this is explicitly taught with the acquisition of the Chinese writing here in public schools?
Yes, this kind of explicit teaching doesn't really occupy a lot of curriculums in here, but more in countries not in China, outside China. Yeah, because the children here, they have a lot of exposures to the print and to the oral language, so that their involvement of this kind of awareness is much natural, is much easier, but not really for the children outside China. That's why we need to have more explicit teaching to strengthen this kind of development of the ability.
On that topic of teaching, actually, I noticed that some of your expertise is on computer-assisted language learning. Is this heavily involved in the teaching of Chinese internationally in heritage Chinese?
Nowadays, it is. Right. Nowadays, a lot of Chinese teachers, I think it's all the language teachers are doing the same. They are trying very hard to find out how technology can help the learners to improve their language learning. Yeah, so we can see a lot of modern language teachers, they actively sit computer softwares and having human-computer interactions so that they can improve the language learning by the communication with the machine alone or with the community via the computers. So mm-hmm. with this kind of assistance, yeah, the learning of language can be much promoted.
Thank you. Why do you think your findings in this chapter are significant? How can they benefit international learners of Chinese?
Yes. For my study, as we mentioned just now, this is the focus on heritage language learners. So as we might know, in the US, they wanted to have they wanted to encourage a lot of people to learn foreign languages, not really in the past, because in the past, American people, they are so proud of English, they didn't really want to learn other languages, but not really after 9/11. And many people, the government tried to promote foreign language learning. So if we ask non-Chinese speaking children to learn Chinese, we will have to put a lot of efforts. But if we rely on the heritage learners to improve their Chinese or other languages, right? They improve their heritage language learning. So that would be much more effective.
Mm. Were there any practical recommendations you have for a teacher of heritage language Chinese?
Yes. So for that, we will encourage the teachers to make very good use of the resource, because the children, they have the resource of both Chinese and English. And as I mentioned in the paper, actually some of the reading skills can be transferred from English to Chinese. Yeah. For example, the children can know more about the content of the reading by getting the gist. Okay, so this kind of ability transfer from English, so that the children, they don't have to learn how to read like from the scratch. Yeah, they will have another level that can be a more holistic level that can be transferred from the society language. So if the teacher can make good use of both of the resources, English and Chinese, so the language teaching methodology can be much improved, so that the children can learn much more effectively this way.
I noticed that the chapter is part of a wider book. Yeah, the book is Reading in Chinese as an Additional Language. Is this a growing body of literature right now? Are there a lot of publications coming out on this subject? And if so, why?
True. This kind of subject is getting more and more scholarly attentions, not just because of morphological awareness, also because of the close relationship between the morphological awareness and reading. Yes. So because a lot of people, they realize if we want to develop reading, just read alone would not help that much. So we need to have some studies on how to analyze the language. So linguistically, how do we analyze the language and then combine with the interesting reading materials so that reading can be further promoted? And this is one aspect. Okay. And there are some other reasons why this kind of literature is attracting more attentions. Yeah. So another reason I mentioned just now is that a lot of bilingualism and multilingualism are being promoted nowadays. So many people are learning several languages nowadays. So how do we promote this kind of multilingualism and multiliteracy? That means the ability to read and write would be quite important too. So a lot of teaching, we don't just stop at teaching people how to speak and how to communicate. Yeah, we want people to further promote reading and further learn the language by themselves. That's the concept, reading to learn. So if we get the ability to read, we can learn extensive knowledge by reading. So reading literacy would be quite important. So that's why this kind of study, learning more languages and learning multilingualism are so important nowadays.
I really like that importance placed upon reading. So I'm sure there are lots of parents listening to this. And so the message is, make sure your child is reading, basically, I think. Also, looking at the wider book again, how did your paper come to be published in this collection? Did you see a call for papers, or were you invited in some way? Can you tell us a bit about the journey to publication? Because there's not just you, there's a few authors on this paper, isn't there?
This paper is an invited publication. Yeah. So we have the small community who work on the reading of Chinese and the development of heritage language. And then the two editors, when they try to publish a book on this topic, they invited all the people they know in this field. And then I'm one of them who are being invited. So we contribute to this chapter.
So there are three of you writing this together. Is that right? Sort of three authors on this chapter?
Four authors.
Four authors, yes. On the chapter. No. So can you tell us a little bit about your co-authors and how you came to work together?
Okay. Second author is Professor Keiko Koda. She is the very influencing person in the study of writing, orthography, and second language reading. And she authored a book, a classic in the field. It's called Insights into Second Language Acquisition. Oh, sorry. Insights in Second Language Reading. Okay, that's the title of the book. Of course, she contributed a lot in terms of the theory in the book chapter. And another two authors, one of them is called Qinlong Yang, and he is a psychologist. And he had been working in the psychology of reading and a lot of behavioral experiments on reading. So he was quite interesting in the chapter. And then we collaborated to run the study together. And another author, Chan Lü, and she had been in the field of Chinese reading and Chinese orthography for a long time. So four of us, we met together when we were in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, United States. And so we found our mutual interest together, and then we worked together for this project.
This sounds like a collection of very heavy hitters. I have to say, they all sound very prestigious academics, the group of you working together here. I like the idea that there is also a small community of you who's interested in this topic. You've talked us through your findings and through your processes. Has there been any actual criticism of the article? Has there any kind of been any conversation that has been started by this? Is there any limitations, any invited critique that you can think of?
Yes. One of the important critique is about the comparison between the heritage language learners with the native language speakers in Beijing. Because some people say that, yeah, maybe they are not really comparable because you use different materials, right? The comparison from Beijing, their data are from another study. So, of course, for our study, we use the experimental materials. We take a reference of that study, but they are not really exactly the same materials, because for our children, we have to adapt some of the content and some of the tests. So some of the critics come from this. And I think this is a major criticism, whether the two populations are really that comparable.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, do you think that is valid? And how do you get around that?
As far as we are concerned, we regard this as valid comparison, because the ages of the children, they match together. And then the nature of the experiments, the nature of the test materials are similar, very similar. We try very hard to match the two, although they are not exactly the same. Because this is not a kind of laboratory study, it's very hard to make everything exactly the same. So we can just ensure the majority, the most parts are the same. So we are still confident the two studies are comparable.
There are so many variables in this type of study as well. I admire it because there's a lot of ground being broken here. The idea of studying heritage learners is particularly fascinating because they are fundamentally different from all sorts of other learners. And so any insights you can gain there is important, I think. But I was wondering about the Beijing cohort. So they would be speaking Mandarin and then studying in Mandarin. So they don't have the same potential issues as other communities where the spoken language is actually quite different than the system being used to write, or even in Hong Kong, you have Cantonese speakers who are studying in Mandarin, and there are difficulties between even different versions of Chinese, are there not?
Right. There are differences of different versions of Chinese, especially the version in America and in the heritage children. Of course, the language they use are mostly daily language. So, yeah, the Children in Beijing, they use a lot of academic language because the children, they have to learn how to write compositions in Chinese. Of course, in Hong Kong, it's totally a different story. Yeah, because in Hong Kong, children, they don't learn how to write Chinese characters through pinyin system. They just learn it. Yeah, that means the children have to force themselves to use rote memory to memorize the Chinese characters.
It's all very difficult, but nevertheless, you know, being able to give us an insight into this community and show, you know, some of the differences, I think is quite fascinating. So the real question, Yanhui, is where do you go from here? So are there any plans to expand the study into different realms, use different populations? I was fascinated by this because, of course, it is an English-speaking community in which Chinese is being learned. Are there any other places you could take it to, for example?
There are many possibilities for extensions for this kind of study. Yeah, we can compare the children with adults and compare the heritage children with adult second language learners. Yeah, to see how they learn the language, how to learn how to write similarly or differently. And also, we can also take another population like children with disabilities. Yeah, so we all know that there are more and more children with autism or children with dyslexia. Yeah, how do they learn how to read and write? So we all want try to understand this kind of learning and their trajectory of learning, the unique forces involved in this reading and learning capacities, how they develop these capacities.
Does your team have specific plans to move things forward?
Not exactly right now, but we, of course, we intend to move forward by involving, especially involving some native English speakers, how they learn and do such kind of comparisons. Yeah, there are many details we want to get to know. Yeah, for example, we just mentioned like the transparency of characters and consistencies of the pronunciation of the phonetic radicals and how would that influence language learning, right? Yeah, so many details we want to know. So we would surely expand the study to further details.
Well, also make sure you include our language and pedagogy laboratory here because we
I knew you'd get that in.
Got to get that plug in. But she's a member.
Uh-huh. I was actually more interested in, do you have any plans to study the context here? Because when I sort of walk to work in the morning, I hear so many different languages from so many different people from different backgrounds. And people here, including the children that I see on campus, speak often three or four languages. So do you have any plans to study perhaps a population closer to home, maybe?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have some collaborations with the language centers here. So we have already studied the students here. Yeah, how do they study a third language? And I also have another study that studies Ningbo children and how do they learn their dialects, Ningbo dialects. So because like a lot of parents, they don't want their children to speak dialects. The parents always speak 普通话 with the children.
Are you a Ningbonese speaker yourself?
I'm not, but I have my research assistants. They are all Ningbonese. Yeah, they were helping me to collect data and analyze the data. Yeah, we were trying to develop corpus and then use the corpus to study children's dialect learning and university students' third language acquisition.
Thank you very much. We're very happy to see where you go in the future with this. And please do come back and share your future research with us, Yanhui. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Yanhui.
Surely I will share more of my studies in the future. Thank you for the interview today.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.